This is a podcast from Shooting People.
Tremendous thanks to the panel for coming along today, to Shooting People for helping to organise the panel. The panel is also organised with the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Insight, of which I am one of the managers, runs short courses and events like this from the school, and you'll have a handout with some of them there. Without further ado, I'll get on with things and I'll pass over to Jay.
Hello, everyone.
Could you turn off your mobile phones if you have?
Yes, mobiles off, please. Hello, everyone. Welcome to SOAS. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, David. Thank you, Tommy, and good luck. Technical glitch, nonsense. Just trying to build anticipation. Everything's absolutely fine. The swan will glide gracefully across the pond. Welcome to SOAS London on this bright wintry Wednesday, the 12th of December. That little scene setter, ladies and gentlemen, as today's panel is being audio and video, for that matter, recorded, and an edited version of the audio will be published on Shooting People as a podcast on Friday. So, panellists and indeed audience, mind your language. I'm James Mulligan. I'm the creative director of Shooting People. Any members in? Very good. Everyone else, what's the matter with you? All of you who just raised your hands, you're guaranteed success. Shooting People is a global network of independent filmmakers, a social networking community, if you will, that predated the rest of them. We have 34,000 members around the world, and yet in some ways we are the dinosaur in the room. We are interactive only in that using a very old-fashioned thing called email, members can interact with each other and cast and crew their short films, keep up to date with all the news that's in the independent filmmaking community. We have audience interactivity as today's discussion, and some of the following questions will be essayed by our illustrious panel, whom I will introduce in a second. What is interactivity and how does it change the relationship between the artists, performers, programmers and the audience? Does it indeed change that relationship? What unique aesthetic and political opportunities does interactivity bring in different media, and is it leading to a convergence or divergence between traditional media? How far can audiences create their own content individually and collectively? What possibilities remain for more traditional spectatorship? How can you make your work more interactive? Budget levels surrounding that, is it an expensive proposition making art interactive? All this and more to be talked about by our panel, whom I'll introduce now. On my immediate left is Luke Himes, a filmmaker and writer-director of the interactive Channel 4 TV series Dubplate Drama, which is produced by the production company Red Mullet. Luke is currently developing a new interactive TV series premised on social networking and a number of feature films. Amongst his many credits, and he's indeed a Shooting People member, hence this success guarantee I was talking about earlier, he was the head writer of the Bebo interactive drama Kate Modern. At the table on my left is Colin Marsh and Ewan Maybank. Colin's the producer at Punch Drunk and Ewan's the technical director. The company creates cutting-edge theatre in which audiences are free to choose what they watch and where they go. Their latest sold-out production is an adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's The Mask of the Red Death for the Barbican.
The Arts Centre.
Is it? Correction. Keeping me on my toes. Which masked audiences roam an entire building and follow any theme, plotline or performer they choose. To my immediate right is Jew Rofar, one of the leaders of Blast Theory, who are renowned internationally as one of the most adventurous artist groups who use interactive media. The group's work explores interactivity and the relationship between real and virtual space with a focus on the social and political aspects of technology. Projects have included the award-winning Can You See Me Now, Uncle Roy All Around You, and I Like Frank, the world's first mixed reality game for 3G phones. On Jew's immediate right is Ricard Grass, the creative director of La Interactiva, an official developer for the virtual world Second Life and an acclaimed pioneer of machinima, the new medium combining film, animation and computer games. Jeremy Boxer isn't to Ricard's right and will be at some point. He's checking his emails on Facebook, presumably, but as I introduce him as a curator and programmer, he's worked for Tomorrow Unlimited. Previous to that, he was head of global programming for ResFest, and he's a short filmmaker in his own right, has made over 40 short films and music videos, plural. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please put your hands together for the panel? The format of the day is I'm soon to wind up these rather long-winded opening remarks and get the panel talking, whom you've come to see. Each of the panellists, and in the order in which I introduce them, are going to give a presentation, which will involve the internet, despite the fast kicking behind us. After each of the presentations has finished, we're going to straight away have the roaming mic go around you can interact, as seems appropriate, with them. We're going to finish bang at 4 o'clock. So, by way of getting it going, Luke, you're going to play us some of your work, and I'm going to pose this question to you. How really can TV possibly be interactive?
Well, I think the answer to how TV can really be interactive is if you have people making it who are crazy and hardworking enough to do the amount of work you need to do to actually make a real, credible, interactive property. The first thing we're going to have a look at today is a show called Dub Plate Drama, which just ended this past week. It was on for 12 weeks. It's a show at its heart about a young girl who's trying to make it in the world of underground rap music in this country, grime and that kind of thing, and kind of the dangerous underworld that surrounds it. It was a series of 12 half hours, and in 2005 we did a first series, which was sort of six 15 minute episodes. So the format kind of grew. Let's watch a little clip of the show now, and then I'll go into a bit more detail about how the interactivity worked. Right, so that, I'm sure many of you are thinking that's all very well, some nice images there, but what has that got to do with interactivity? Well, the answer to that is that every episode of Dub Plate Drama builds up to a moral cliffhanger or dilemma that one of our characters has to face at the end of every episode. And the kind of episode ends just as they're about to make this decision, and then we have a host or a narrator, this guy called Rodney P, come out, and he basically breaks down the two different ways that the character could go. Like, for instance, one of our characters and one of the dilemmas, he was directing a music video. The people who paid for the music video, they were a bit on the criminal side. Some alcohol got spread around. Everyone got a bit drunk. Things got out of control. One of the girls got punched. And then the police turned up. And this character was in the situation of should he... He was asked by the police, basically, he was going to get a fine if he didn't own up to as to where the guy who hit the girl was. And so it was a simple dilemma of A, if you think he should tell the police where the guy was and risk the consequences, or B, if you think he should keep his mouth shut and risk the fine he may get from the police. So really, the secret of a good dilemma is that you would kind of have a balance of like, oh, I don't know which way people are going to vote every week. Because the whole idea behind having the interactivity of Dub Plate Drama was to get young people discussing issues that perhaps they wouldn't normally be discussing. So, you know, a lot of times you see a lot of programs that are quite worthy and are like, oh, wow, well, let's get kids talking about these issues and blah, 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 blah. And with Dub Plate Drama, what we wanted to do is just, like I say, have young people talk about the dilemmas that happen to the characters, whether it's, you know, pregnancy or gun crime or, you know, many of the different things that we did over the sort of 16, 17 episodes that had dilemmas. So it was a way to get people talking. And I've had a lot of good feedback from teachers and people from universities around the place that have said that, you know, they hadn't heard kids talking about these issues in such a way. And they feel as if a lot of young people actually came away getting something from it. As you'll see in a moment, I think that so far in my career, I've worked with two different types of interactivity. There's puppet master interactivity, which is what Dub Plate Drama is, and then there's one-on-one interactivity, which we'll get onto in just a second. But as far as the puppet master interactivity of Dub Plate Drama went, I think this worked really well. I was really pleased with it. Like I said in answer to James's question at the beginning, how do you actually make real interactive TV? Well, the answer is, you, with Dubhead Drama, for instance, you write two versions of the story and actually film both. And so in the week of TX, you are able to edit in which way the audience vote. The voting in the first series was an SMS thing. It was SMS and online. And in the second series, because of the controversy with the recent stuff with the premium rate numbers and all those silly ITV game shows, we decided to just host the voting through MySpace. So people could go onto MySpace, become a friend of ours on MySpace, and then basically click through and vote there. And I'm in a good position to talk about it now. The series has ended. We got 105,000 votes throughout the whole series. The biggest vote was on episode 6, where one of the characters' mothers had the dilemma, should she go outside with her walking stick to try and save her son from some robbers when the police have said they're 10 minutes away, or should she stay inside? We had 19,000 votes on that issue alone. And what was great about that was just watching how the statistics went back and forth. You know, I literally would log on every day and it would go back and forth, back and forth. In the first series, I was privy to this information from the text company. They would ring me up every morning and go, oh yeah, we're 55% that way. And that was really exciting for me. So in the second series, I wanted to make sure that we could actually show that on MySpace so people could see where the votes were going and actually keep abreast of it. So yeah, that's Dubplate Drama. The second series is finished now. I'll be honest with you, originally the whole idea of interactivity just came about as a way to get it onto television. I had the series for some time and nobody really wanted to work with us. And then the show always had these big cliffhangers every week. And then because we were only pitching to do kind of 11-minute episodes with the first series, we worked out that we could actually afford to film both versions instead of doing half-hour episodes. And with the second series, we became more confident and worked out other ways to make it a kind of modular experience where you kind of ride out the edit and replace things as you go. You know, it's a little difficult to keep track of, but it's quite exciting. Now, anyway, that's enough about Dubplate Drama. I mentioned two types of interactivity. We're going to go on to the next thing now, which is the social networking drama that I have been doing since July for the company Bebo. And we're going to watch a little bit of that real quickly. And then if we could run the interactivity piece on that as well. Yeah.
Cake Modern is unique in a number of ways. It is totally interactive, funded entirely by advertising and brand integration, and along with Lonely Girl 15 is the world's first drama to be broadcast on a social networking website. Although fans don't directly control the storyline, they have the opportunity to interact with the characters through their Bebo profiles, talk to other fans about the plot, and upload their own original and remix videos to the Cake Modern show page. Although the show lives on Bebo and LG15.com, it's also distributed 24 hours later on YouTube and other video websites, and through a dedicated portal on msn.co.uk. The fans even run their own LG15 blog that reports on the Lonely Girl 15 and Cake Modern show universe. The interactivity also crosses into the real world. We regularly hold live events, the first of which was in August on Carnaby Street, and it brought fans and spectators directly into the plot of the show. The event was essentially an interactive piece of street theater that immersed fans in a murder scene, including police vehicles, sirens, and body bags. The fans reported details of the event and uploaded videos via Wi-Fi laptops before the official K-Modern video was uploaded to Bebo. Following in the footsteps of Lonely Girl 15 and its 70 million views worldwide, Cake Modern is already surpassing the very high standards set by its older sister. Between Bebo and its distribution partners, Cake Modern has received millions of views and tens of thousands of comments, and has been covered internationally in the press, including an upcoming article in Rolling Stone magazine. These numbers, and the millions of views achieved weekly by Lonely Girl 15, firmly place the two shows as the top entertainment properties on the internet.
So I think you'll probably agree you'd be hard-pressed to find two more different shows, but, you know. So there is the second way of doing interactivity. This is a social networking drama. Each of the characters has their own page on the Bebo social network. We encourage our fans to write to each of the characters. I have, don't tell the fans, but I have an interactive supervisor whose job every day is to build up and develop relationships with the different fans. When I write a script, I also write him an interactive brief in which he has a detailed outline of what the characters are feeling each day, how they're reacting to the different videos that are posted. The format is that 6 days a week, a 2 to 3 minute video is posted. It's the characters themselves are filming the videos, filming the things that happen in their lives. And one of the most exciting bits of doing Kate Modern, because you know it's very different to Double Eight Drama. There's a, it's all kind of with Double Eight Drama, everyone accepts that it's a show. But with Kate Modern, the idea is that the fans are kind of in on it, and the characters are their friends rather than characters on a program. Probably the most exciting thing so far about doing Kate Modern has been we've done 7 live events so far, where we've been brave enough to build up a plot point in the series, and then invite the fans to come along on a specific date, time, and place to get involved in a plot point. And it was sort of briefly talked about there with that Carnaby Street event. Since then, we've done an art show that turned into an assassination attempt, and we've also done a week of treasure hunt stuff sponsored by Microsoft, where the characters were searching for some missing software, and the fans came along to each, decoded each of the locations of where the gnome containing the piece of the clue would be every day, and the fans came along. Some of them even took a week off work to come and follow the trail every single day. And they brought their own cameras, and we encouraged them to bring their own cameras and basically make their own little videos, which often they would take and upload to the internet before we'd even had a chance. So it's kind of like a street theater thing. It's, you know, millions of miles away from what these guys are doing with the Punch Drunk stuff, you know. But it's an experiment. For our first event, we only had 7 fans turn up. For our second event, 21 fans turned up. And then we had sort of different levels of fans turn up every day for our sort of week of puzzle live events. So that's been a really, really exciting experience. And so that basically, there you have it. Those are 2 different interactive projects that I've been working on. Very different interactive projects and 2 very different ways of doing things.
Thanks, Luke. I'm sure, I know I've got half a dozen burning questions to ask you after that presentation, but that will be what we get to once we've been through everyone. Colin and Ewan, hi, welcome. Tell us, are you putting on theatre for new audiences, or are you dragging the residents of Farnham into the 21st century?
Okay. can I just ask people in the audience how many, if any of you, have seen any of Punch Drunk's live performance work? That's good. Great. Well, for you and for everyone else, I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking about the kind of work that we do, because in the sense of it being theatre, it is quite, we would think, or say, revolutionary, for the kind of reasons that this debate today is raising. The audience for Punch Drunk's theatre work are as important to the experience of the evening as the performance itself. In fact, they are the third part of the equation in the structured performances that we present. There's the live content, which is based usually on a classic story or a recognisable story, which audience members can or cannot have any knowledge of prior to seeing the show. The second part is the installation-based nature of the work, in which the set, to put it simply, is a player in the experience of the evening. And the third part is the random audience, collection of random people that turn up to see the show every night. The work is obviously very, very structured, but the revolutionary aspect of it, I think we would say, is that the audience are continually presented with choices on a very individual personal level. We use a device at the moment in the live shows by which the audience are asked to wear a mask throughout the evening, pretty much for the whole evening. There's always one space where they can take the mask off and, if you like, chill out and relax. But generally, the format is that the audience are individualised by the simple theatrical device of wearing a mask over their face, which there are all sorts of impacts and conflicts that raises during the experiential process. But for most people, it gives them a sense of being privileged at something that's happening there and then just for them, within a large group of people. The reason I kind of point that out is that the experience of watching the show can appear to be improvised and quite chance-driven. And I think for the company, that's the most interesting aspect of the work that we're trying to make on an ongoing basis. How far can we go in giving a live audience a sense that their own responses and essentially their own imagination is creating and constructing their own story. Punch Drunk basically we call it immersive theatre. We've had lots of debate over the years. Ewan might want to add to this. Ewan is a founding member of the company, and essentially it was founded by a bunch of guys studying drama at Exeter University about 7 or 8 years ago. Who were driven really by the tedium of watching conventional proscenium arch theatre, and they wanted to find a way of placing the audience in the middle of the action and also giving the audience an opportunity to have the freedom to construct the action. And there are lots of questions that raises about how interactive the work actually is. There are rules there have to be in order to contain the show in a limited period of time each evening, and in order to ensure that as many audience members as possible can extract as much content and meaning as they can. But other than that, there are no rules at all, no visible rules. The audience are literally, as James said, free to go wherever they like, watch whatever they like, and make their own choices. And I think that's where I'd start to try to answer your question, which is that in the sense of the audience having the freedom to construct their own experience without any apparent direction other than the sensory experience that they're receiving. Because the other thing I should say is that the performances use a physical language. There's very little clue given to the audience through text, through spoken word, very, very little indeed. So it's purely a visual sensory environment, and the audience are free to treat it as a performance or, in some cases, purely as an exhibition that they might wander through. And in that sense, I think that it is a new audience. They may well be people who go to the theatre, go to art galleries, go to cinema, don't do any of those things, spend all their time playing computer games. But essentially, it's a new audience in terms of the live experience that they're being offered.
Ewan, what are some of the challenges for a technical department of a theatre company that would work that way?
You could say they're quite extensive in that, because in a conventional theatre space, whether it be a studio-based piece or, as Colin says, in a proscenium-based space, because there's a boundary between the performance space and the audience space, the most the audience are ever going to experience the technical facilities of the space is, they might see some of the lights, they might see some of the speakers and things, and in that respect, it doesn't matter really, because the focus is on the performance. However, in what we do, the audience scrutinises absolutely everything. They, some people, as Colin says, will spend a lot more time with the set, and the performance will go on around them, and that will be their primary focus. But if that's the case, of course, then they're going to find everything that breaks the spell of the show. If they are doing that, so there's a great deal of disguise. We have to, instead of running things through spaces, we may have to spend a ridiculous amount of time and effort just tracing a cable or something out of the space, so that when somebody looks at, for example, a 1950s radio, they're imagining that it's actually an actual working radio. But do you want me to move my mic?
No, I think you're right.
Okay, cool. They'll look at that and they'll think, oh, that's a radio. But if they were to look behind it, they'd find that it's a speaker that is an extension of a network that runs all the way back to the control point. So in that respect, it's incredibly complicated just to get around the fact that the audience will examine it. A bit of a rambling answer, but you know, it does throw up further a lot of issues, really. And let alone the fact that the buildings you go into, you're having to put all the facilities in that you would normally take for granted in a traditional theatre space.
Yeah. I mean, the audience is presumably, maybe almost tried to say, willingly suspending their disbelief as well also. And I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they're not really trying to break a spell. No one's in one of your spaces thinking they've slipped through a wormhole back to you know, Edgar Allan Poe's South or anything. But
I don't know. You'd have to ask the audience, really.
Yeah.
I think, yes, there's a bargain you obviously sign up for when you enter the theatre. If you like, things like the mask, they're devices, and most people would take that at face value and maybe not worry too much about it. But for me, what's interesting is how the imagination can trigger people into situations, if you like, or into responses that they may not normally have, where they're more mediated by text or by sitting in the same space, watching, looking at something in one direction with other people, those kinds of things. I think that's why we've come around to the definition of it being immersive, because it really does, it always plays on the audience's sense of anticipation and adventure, and it's constantly asking you to go further. And one of the interesting things about that as an evening is the way that it animates people afterwards to talk to each other in a way that you don't witness usually at, you know, the National Theatre or the Hen and Chickens or whatever. And I don't mean to sort of, you know, dismiss that kind of response to a play or a work of art, but generally it animates people in an incredibly intense, personal way in terms of wanting to share with each other what they've experienced in a very immediate way.
Do you have a way in which you collect audience reaction, either during the run of a production that then continues to inform that show or then develops you as a creative team?
Yeah, we particularly use feedback that we get from our website. People, on a daily basis, we get people writing sometimes quite lengthy responses to the experience that they've had the night before or a few days before. In quite a consistent way, people often start off the same way in their emails. You know, I saw your show 3 days ago and I haven't stopped thinking about it since. It strikes me as being quite unusual. Not just in terms of the desire to express something back, but the fact that the works obviously had quite a visceral and intellectual effect that people are still trying to sort of fathom afterwards. Mm. I think that's partly because the work can appear to be like some sort of gigantic puzzle that is there to be solved, and that's great, because in a sense it is, and that's true for the performers as well, because the performers, just on a kind of technical note, the performers only know the parts of the action that they're in themselves. They very often haven't seen any of the rest of the show because it's devised and it's rehearsed in such a way that it's dependent on people being in the right space to do that work. So the company performers at the show that we're doing at the moment, there are 27 performers. Of that group, there's only really I suppose, one performer who sees pretty much everything that goes on in one particular space, that's in a music hall space that we've built into the set. In the rest of the cast, outside, if you like, in the world of Edgar Allan Poe, the performers only know the bits that they're in. So they're actually on equal terms with the audience in that sense, I think.
I was going to say, in the side of the feedback sort of question, what is interesting is actually the fact that the audience have there's an allowance for them to be within the show to directly feedback their feelings and their sort of the physical impulses of what the show presents to them. I mean, from say we've always had a feedback system at the end of the show, be it a feedback book or the online feedback we have. But also in the space, there's almost always been documents as part of the set primarily, and originally we never thought of them in that way, but where there's an open book and there's a pen, people naturally write things. And, you know, and they'll, you know, sometimes you'll find amazingly insightful comments, other times perhaps not. But, well, maybe insightful, but... But alongside that, you have people's physical reactions to it. In that, you know, we find people who have really taken issue with what they've been presented with, and some people will stick with it, and then they will, you know, they'll want to talk about it with the company afterwards. Some people have walked out. They said, "That's it. I can't take any more," quite literally, or I don't want any more of this. And in a conventional setting, there's a certain need to stay in the space, unless something is really terrible, really offensive, or the complete opposite of what you're used to in theatre. I think very few people would ever walk out of a theatre until, say, the interval came along, and then they might sneak away. But within our shows, you know, you can just say, okay, I've had enough, and go. Or you can, you know, you feed back within the space to by really trying to interact with the performers. Some people won't, some people will.
Great, thank you. Segueing then perhaps from consideration of user immersive experience to user generated content. Jude, tell us what Blast Theory is doing to tear up the preconception that UGC is little more than a fat kid falling off a moped on YouTube.
God, I knew he was going to ask this question. It's such a bitch of a question. Well, I think what I'd like to do in my response to that is basically talk to you about a piece of work which we recently showed at the Barbican in October, which directly asks for members of the audience or the players or the users, the participants, whichever term you choose to prefer, to directly answer questions about their lives within the project. As they cycle through the streets of London, you can turn up with your bike or you can use one of our bikes, and we attach a games console, or an internet tablet in fact, onto the bike, and a narrative or a voice lulls you hopefully into a sense of saying things perhaps out loud that you haven't before, perhaps going to places in the city that you haven't been to before, and maybe making some connections between those two things. I'll show you the video because I think it sort of is quite self-explanatory in a way, but just on a sort of technical nerd factor, it uses Wi-Fi hotspots around the city, and that is where we attach the content. So one of the nice things about it in terms of giving agency to members of the public to be co-authors or part creators within the work is that their content is out there for the duration of those Wi-Fi hotspots being active. You go out the next day, it might not be there. If you go out with any other device, it's not there. So it's very private. And of course, like Punch Drunk say, you know, people's ability to take it or leave it or treat it seriously, how far they're committed or immersed within that is dependent on lots of factors, one being whether somebody's been on a bike in the last 10 years or not. I think I'll show it. I'll show that first, and then I'll just say something else. I'm going to speak very briefly because I know we've got a short amount of time. So we've literally just finished the work, so this is just a 2-minute brief video just to give a flavour of the work. It's not finished documentation. So. One thing I should have said, slightly threw me there, I just actually should introduce the fact that I'm only one of the three artists of Blast Theory. We are a group of six, and of course my opinion is just one third of the three artists within Blast Theory. And we've been working together since 1991, making interactive work, and we're based in Brighton. So I just wanted to give you a little biog. What I wanted to sort of do, I suppose, in showing this piece of work is express one of our concerns around this work with regard to sort of user-generated content. I think there's a sort of conventional wisdom that by inviting members of the public to create content, that all content is good. And I'd just like to sort of problematize that idea. I think the challenge is to create circumstances in which good content is produced, and is produced as much as possible and as quickly as possible, and is made to perform within a work. And I'm talking about that quite broadly. I think for us, one of the other biggest challenges with regard to content and location-based games is that content relates. Is how content relates to place. How do you make a piece of work in a city where you don't have to go out and author for every single location in that city, in every single place that you actually make that piece of work? In Uncle Royal Around You, a piece that we made in 2003 around the ICA in London, we actually did author content ourselves as Blast Theory for every single location around the Mall and Pall Mall and Regent Street and the surrounding areas of the game that members of the public could find as they went around those streets with a handheld device. Or if you're online, you could also find those sort of aspects of the content. But obviously it's problematic and time-consuming, and we want to make lots of good artwork, and we can't do that everywhere we go.
Very good. Thank you, Drew. Rickard, don't be scared. The internet's working. Everything's going to be fine.
I'll be fine.
Yeah.
There's ways around it.
Yeah. Rickard, to answer this poser by way of getting your presentation going, how have virtual worlds changed the way we interact with content?
Ha. You heard it already from me. Okay. Virtual worlds, people talk about them like if they were some kind of religion. And I think they are the new kids on the block, and that doesn't mean to say that they're best kids on the block. I think, however, that anybody who's into creating content, organizations, educational institutions, and so on, needs to look into them and analyze if they are any good for what they do in any ways. I think that's kind of something we all have to do. We all have to keep learning with technology. At some point, we won't cope, and I'm nearly there. But, you know, it's a must. And in that sense, I can only speak from experience, and it's been fantastic in the sense that when I've been into research for nearly 8-9 years, and I was doing a lot of... whenever we had to do content, we had to create the technology. When virtual worlds came around, we thought, great, you know, technology is ready. We can now focus on content. And also, the virtual worlds, luckily, come as a package, in a way that communication angle of things is also sorted. So in terms of communication with audience or between audience, and in terms of distribution, if you think of something like there.com or Caniva or Second Life, people can exchange files, objects, chats, and even you can relate that to email, and very, very soon you can even use your mobile phone to interact with virtual world. So of course it's opened a lot of opportunities in many different ways, and there's a lot of examples that we could be talking about. I'll show you some later. But I think that the worry, and that's something which it's very obvious when you've been producing content for a long time, is that the fact that technology enables great things doesn't mean to say that technology is good. I think technology alone is useless, it's idiotic, but it needs a human component. And that's where, and that's the motto of what we do, which is to look at new technology and try and explore ways of exploiting it creatively. Luckily, sometimes we manage to make money out of what we produce, but we have to remember to have, or to keep researching and to keep testing things, and look at it from an artistic angle, which means that sometimes things go terribly wrong, but at least we learn and move on from it.
The first example I'm going to show to you is a machinima. Most of what we do now is machinima-based or virtual worlds-based. The first example is a machinima which we make with a game that most of you will be able to recognize. I'm sure pretty much all of you. And I'm just going to show you a clip from it, and then I'll discuss about the process. Does anybody recognize this game?
Seems to.
I'm going to tell you about the process in a second, but before I go any further, Sims 2 is a game developed by Electronic Arts, and they gave us permission for this documentary, just like Sega and Sony have in the past. And as you might be aware, Sims is all about managing these little people, these 3D characters. You tell them what to eat, when to eat, if they can go to the toilet, if they can go to work, and so on. So you control their lives. And in order for us to do this short, all I did was I did not feed them, I did not send them to the toilet, and I had them bored at home 24/7. So they started to fight with each other. The game, the artificial intelligence of the game does that by default when you don't do that to the characters. So we extracted all the pieces where he was being bad to her, but she was brutal. She was far worse than him. But of course, for the piece, it didn't make any sense. So what we did is we engaged with the artificial intelligence of the game, tried to negotiate to a point where we could go around it and we could get the content that we wanted. But I wanted to show you this example because I think it clarifies the uniqueness of machinima. Machinima is a word that was created in Scotland by a couple of drunks in a pub. And they are friends of mine, so I can say that. They're great people, Anthony Bailey and Hugh Hancock. What they did was they were thinking of creating a word for machinima, the real-time animation, and they came up with the idea that they should mix machine and cinema. And that's why it was created in 2001. But it's great because it creates content quickly, creates content cheaply. So if you want to create anything and you don't have much of a budget, it's possibly the quickest and cheapest way of creating an animation. And however, as a genre, it's very unique. Because if for all of you who might have played The Sims, you know how I've made this, and you know how to make this, and you've spent hundreds of hours or tens of hours within this environment interacting with characters such as this. So you have an immediate emotional engagement with that game, which I am exploiting by making a machinima out of it. So that is very, you know, when you watch a 2D animation, a 3D animation, of course, it costs a lot of money, so don't do that. But my point is that as an author, you want your audience to engage emotionally with your piece. But if you don't use a game, you have a lot of freedom, but you have to make a lot of effort and get it right to engage your audience. With machinima, that engagement is automatic, okay? And we've used over 10 games over the past 7-8 years, so we kind of know how to play with that, and it's very, very kind of tricky. I'll quickly now tell you how I got into machinima, and it kind of made me laugh because a lot of people on the panel have spoken about the kind of the problems they went into in their careers, which made them reach really brave decisions, like look, and the reason why I got to machinima was because I wanted to make an interactive movie, and I had interactive DVD software. I told you that I was doing research, so I had a lot of time and a lot of resources, but I didn't have the budget. So when I went to see film companies, they said, because what you want to do is interactive, we're not interested.
course, things have changed, but not that much. There's a huge cultural change out there in the media arena that is still taking place. But they basically they said, because you want to add interactivity to a movie, we can't do this. We don't know how to. Go to the games people. So when I went to the games companies, they said, well, you want to do a movie. So wrong place, mate. So they closed all the doors that I had at the moment. And all I said, well, I'm going to use my PlayStation. And at 4 a.m. one day, just decided to do that. And then somebody told me what I was doing was called Machinima. And there was people out there doing that. Okay, I'm just going to jump now into virtual worlds. And the reason why we got into virtual worlds was because after many years of making Machinima, a lot of companies started to approach us and they said, we want to create something commercially with you using Machinima. And I told you about the games companies being very good to us and they gave us permission. But the level of freedom that we had to develop the content was very limited. We couldn't really change the games to the level that we wanted, and we didn't own the copyright of what we produced. So it's not quite a business model. So we got into virtual worlds in 2004, and we started to develop content in 2005. We became official developers of Second Life, and so on. And we've been exploring virtual worlds in many, many ways, but one of the ways that we've done, or we've kind of enjoyed doing, is the user-generated content, participation with audiences.
Peter, would you like to grab the handheld microphone and take it into the belly of the beast, and we'll get some questions. Who does need to leave early, panel?
You do?
Yeah, yeah, I do.
Do you want to go right now, or do you want to? You can have it. Okay.
Well, we thank you in advance. Okay. We'll maybe give you a big cheer as you try to slip out. Okay, great. As I say, a 2-day conference in 90 minutes. Each panelist who sits before you, with the obvious exception of me, would, I'm sure, enthrall you for at least half a day. We're going to, as I say, publish this as a podcast. But I will collect web links and everything from all of the panelists. I noticed you were writing, you're like that little worm in the TV voting, where the more interested you got, the faster your orange pen went. And I noticed a lot of noting going down. We've been as fascinated by each other as I'm sure you have. So I'll post all that up as a reading list on shooting people. That'll learn you for not being members. Who's got the first question, Peter? Handsome gentleman there with creative facial hair.
No, too kind. With respect to Kane Wodden and the social media and the interactive narrative, firstly, I wanted to ask, hands up, if you've heard of the mid-90s interactive soap opera, The Spot. I'm the only one who remembers it.
Which channel was it on?
Yeah, it was thespot.com.
Okay.
It was a web-based soap opera where the characters posted their diary, posted pictures, posted video, interacted with the audience. They didn't really have street theatre, although they did have the audience meeting the cast in character, quote-unquote, at media events. And because... And I was going to ask, how much do you think we've learned since then, and how much is it simply that the good storytellers are tackling the medium? But if two people in the audience remember thespot.com, then maybe it's a pointless question and I should pass the mic.
Well, I mean, you know, like for instance, Jeremy was just mentioning the last broadcast, which I don't know if many of you have seen it, but it's a film which is basically exactly the same concept of the Blair Witch Project, and made a year before. But for some reason, the Blair Witch managed to create a bit of hype and be a success. And maybe the thing with The Spot is it's not as well known as some things that have come later. Just a word on the sort of creativity is that we have a rule on the program that we always kind of put the entertainment value first before the functionality of the video editing and filming themselves and stuff like that. So we do adhere to the rules, but we always make sure and try and make it an engrossing story first and foremost, and let everything else come second.
Next question, please. Yes, please, Peter, down here in the fourth row.
Yes, it does work.
For the podcast. For Luke, about the sort of the interactive television, for want of a better, sort of, you know, whatever, drama. When you do the sort of like the street theatre parts where you invite people along, say, we are actually going to film here, do you see that there's going to be an evolution to actually, I don't know, putting on parts of the drama which you don't film, but you tell people through like the blogs or the characters' input that would be, oh, you know, so-and-so character, I haven't actually watched it, so I don't know, we're going to meet here on a clandestine sort of thing, so that people who are into it could go with their phones or their cameras and then post it themselves. So I hate to sort of name drop Hollyoaks, but in the way that, say, Hollyoaks Late would happen, and people who were allowed to watch Late Hollyoaks could then see another part of the drama which would inform the rest of Hollyoaks but wouldn't be vital to the overall story arc that, you know, people would, if had missed it, wouldn't be losing out. Can you see that as being a sort of an evolution of the process?
I mean, perhaps. I mean, I think the thing is, whenever we do the live events, it's such an enormous effort to get out there, and we feel that we must do something every time that warrants people travelling from far and wide to actually come and be involved in it and do something that's worthy of them filming. You know, we always have kind of stooge cameras around the place just to make sure to capture things right, because often, you know, it'd be crazy to depend on the fan footage. I think as far as I can see for this show, there will always have to be a filmed element really with it, no matter what we do with the live events.
Next question? Oh, I don't know, you can have one more, because I've got a few more as well. And then to the, and then the gentleman.
Yeah. For Luke, I wondered how important merchandising is in your setup. You were saying earlier about merchandising.
Did I?
You were saying about product placement.
Oh, product placement. Oh, dear. Okay, yeah. Yes, product. How important is product placement? Well, with deals with brands have been the way that I've been able to finance both of the programs. With Double Eight Drum, in association with Childline, where we sold them the bumpers, was quite a straightforward TV way of doing things. In Cape Modern, we have been able to create the show with product integrations, which have involved us, it's terribly boring, but have involved us kind of working products into the actual program, be it a couple of different films or stuff like Gillette or what else have we done?
Cigarettes?
Orange Mobile, MSN, never cigarettes yet.
What's the matter with
No, no cigarettes, no alcohol, unfortunately.
Nowhere left for us.
But yeah, with the product integrations, it's been a challenge for us to basically, because we only have 2 to 3 minutes per day for 5 or 6 days, it's a challenge to meet the expectations of a brand who are investing and not offend our audience. Because the best thing about doing an interactive online drama is that you upload a video, if you go away for 10 minutes and come back, there'll always be a definite piece of feedback there that says whether or not, you know, it was a success or not. So with the first season of Cape Modern, it's been definitely like a bit of trial and error as to what product integrations work for the show and what end up being really clunky. Also, it's a challenge as a writer to be able to grease them in without causing too much problems to the narrative. So that definitely is probably the biggest, apart from the unrelenting workload, product integrations into story is definitely the biggest challenge of working on that drama so far.
Thank you.
Whilst hands consider going to the air, Colin and Ewan, when you were, as a creative team, deciding or addressing the issues which ended up with you using the word immersive, why did you reject the word promenade?
I suppose promenade just is quite a specific genre. And I think it doesn't really fully express the experience that we're trying to provide to the audience. But,
yeah, I guess I'd say
semantics. I mean, it's mobile.
Yeah, other than semantics, I mean, I know I do understand the difference, but is
I think it's part of a theatre history that kind of, certainly for me, because I'm quite old, just it makes me think of walks through the park with Shakespearean scenes, you know, in the leafy Dell, Dingley Dell. I think it's more active and interactive than that. So it's a word that actually Punchdrunk never really has used the word promenade. It's sort of been accreted by press and just by habit as a sort of shorthand so that the audience are clear before they come that they will have to walk around. But other than that, it's kind of redundant, I think.
I guess it's with the word immersive. It's also, I guess, that we are, because we very much control the environment within the spaces we use, we are actually immersing somebody in a very specific environment that we've taken great care to create. Whereas maybe a promenade isn't quite like that, especially the sort of example that Colin gives of an outdoor promenade where there isn't total immersion. It's very much a case of observing a performance that's going on. And there isn't an atmosphere or a space that you can explore without leaving the performance behind. Whereas I think within what we do, it's all very tied together and in that way immersive.
Good, that was purely for me. Anyone want to raise their hand? I will if no one else does. How's that for a little deal? And there's a lady here, but there's also a gentleman up the back who got in first. Put your hand up again. Go on, don't be shy.
This is for Colin and Ewan. I was wondering if Punch Drunk has any interest in sort of expanding their shows beyond the massive theater that Mask the Red Death was in to include an alternate reality game beforehand or anything along those lines that audience members, before they even buy their tickets, can participate in just to continuously expand the experience and make it that much more interactive. And if that's the case, because those ones that I've read about and seen have required massive interaction between the audience members, where one man in the middle of America can decode something, and then he sends what he decoded to somebody in Africa, who then finds the map that the code led them to, which needs someone in Australia then to, actually pick up the item, and how that then the group interaction would differ from what you said the artistic director is interested in with the solitary viewing of the piece.
Yeah, you can answer that.
Yeah.
We are looking, for all sorts of reasons, partly because the company has reached a level in the live performance now where we feel overexposed. The company's sort of founded on not telling the audience very much beforehand. And if you like, the secret's out, the game's up. And I think we would be backing off live theatre for a year or so for lots of reasons. But what's interesting, Felix and other members of the team now, is how to, if you like, find new values in terms of the storytelling through ARG techniques. So yes, watch that space. But Ewan might want to expand on that.
As Colin says, we're at, to be honest, an early stage with that sort of work, in that there is definitely scope for expansion and that kind of interaction within the pieces, and also other interaction with technology that we're looking at beyond the traditional bounds of theatre. It's certainly something we're looking at, but at the same time it's at quite an early stage. Yeah.
While the microphone's coming down to the closest person to me, Jeremy, you must have encountered, apart from Lance Weiler, who you talked about a moment ago, just that ongoing post-live or post-cinema or post- or pre-theatre sort of web-sticky kind of ongoing experience. Have you found other examples of that that you'd
Yeah, I experienced one of Blast Theory's projects in Adelaide, which was called I Like Frank in Adelaide. You would wander around the streets. You'd have a handheld device, and you'd be playing with people online who were all across the world. And they would be sending you messages, and you would have to go and pick up a postcard that was in under one bicycle somewhere and then take it across town to somewhere else and hand it off to someone else. The interesting thing for me that happened was while I was playing the game, they had warned us that there would be marshals in the crowd, and you didn't know who they were. So anybody who had dark sunglasses on and had a mobile phone and was texting, I thought was part of the game. And it kind of, you made this whole kind of weird kind of matrix kind of paranoia kind of set in, and you thought everyone was part of the game and you're moving around, and as soon as you were out of the game, it was kind of like the cloak was lifted and that was it, and you were onto something else. I think that the interesting thing about all these kind of projects that are out there is that it just it satisfies a hunger that audiences are having for to be a part of something and move things in a different direction.
There was a performance at UNIC, yeah, the National Film Theatre, yeah, last year, which is a project from the 1960s, which is, it was organized by Chris Hales, and he's a pioneer in interactive cinema, and he rescued this. The name is Czech. Yeah. It's a Czech project from 67, I believe. Kino Automat, Kino Automat. And it involves interactive cinema and live performance on a stage and audience participation.
Yeah.
That was great to watch.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to...
Oh, look, we're peeling off one by one. Ewan, thank you very much. Hands together for Ewan. Go and see everything they do. We're only going to go for another 5 or so minutes. This lady here.
If you want to go...
It's a question to all of you. How easy was it when you were starting out to get the community around you to help you get the ideas off the ground, to sort of set the balls in motion so you could get going?
Now, do you mean community of people to help make the project?
Yes,
or?
Yeah, I mean, and maybe you're already very involved in a similar field before.
Well, with Dub Play Drama, I'd already been making low-budget music videos for quite some time, and so it's quite easy to draw upon the talent that I'd met making those music videos, both in front of and behind the camera, all of which who were really looking for another big platform and another opportunity to show their work kind of thing. So that was how I rallied the troops on that one. And with Kate Modern, because of the brand involvement that we've had since the very beginning, we've been lucky enough to kind of pick and choose who we'd like to work with.
Sir.
Well, I think with Kate Modern, we kind of look at it as if a week of episodes is a kind of beginning, middle, and end of a story. And within that, we look at the smaller episodes and make sure that there's definitely, a, for lack of a better term, USP for each of the episodes as we go along through the week. We always try and have a sort of intellectual thought at the end of every episode that kind of leads on to the idea of the next episode, which will hopefully get people logging on for the next time, and as well to have some kind of dramatic climax on a Friday that will help people. I mean, like, basically someone suggests, oh, let's go to the fun fair tomorrow or something like that, that will give, you know, but try and be more subtle than that to try and give it give people a reason to come back tomorrow and kind of give it a link together. It's very difficult with the project because now we've got like almost 140 videos online, so people who aren't really familiar with how to navigate that just turn up and just sort of click nice thumbnails that they like, so they never get the idea of the structure. But for the last sort of 10 weeks we've been doing recap videos where we cut each week together into a sort of 5 or 6 minute piece to kind of give people an idea of the narrative. So, you know, we're just trying new things all the time and seeing what works really. I don't have any definite tick boxes for stuff that is the way to do it or not the way to do it.
Go on then. Last question, and it should be from you, shouldn't it?
Okay. My question is for Ricard. And it's as fantastic and accessible as the podcast... I was thinking of the microphone. As fantastic and accessible as the Machinima software is, why do you talk about Machinima as if it's a genre rather than simply quick, cheap CGI for animators?
Good question.
Because we've realized that as a technique it's great because it's possibly the quickest and cheapest way of developing animation. But what we have realized is that when we make Machinima, we are entering into areas which have perhaps not been explored before in that way. For example, online participation with avatars is really quite unique and very, very strange. And yes, there has been cases of live participation and so on, but we're talking about people who are collaborating creatively remotely inside a virtual world, exchanging things. There's a lot of different challenges that, you know, they're based in different locations, different times, so it raises a lot of different questions. We are, for example, working now with real-time animation using mocap. So that, again, it's crazy. And the kind of challenges that we are facing there, they are crazy. And I think that what summarizes the gender aspect is when I showed domestic violence. For those who have watched The Sims, they go, wow, that's The Sims. And there is that emotional engagement that it's very, very strong with people that have spent hundreds of tens of hours sometimes playing a game. And then when they see a movie made with it, you know, that's great. And another good example is Rooster Teeth. The example that you saw before is funny because it's funny, but it's funnier because it's based with Halo, where all the characters are supposed to be killing each other. Well, they're not, and therefore it's immediately funny. And that's something to be aware of, and I think that makes it perhaps not a genre, but a subgenre.
I'm afraid that's it, but can you just, so we can see that. That is a new blog that Shooting People runs, and what I'm going to do is write up a few notes and a few resources, email address, web addresses. I'll ask all of the panel to contribute to that as well, and I'll post that in the next couple of days. And in the spirit of long-tail audience interactivity, you'll be able to respond to it because it's a blog, and continue your dialogue with our wonderful panel, who you are now going to rapturously applaud. Thank you on behalf of all of us to you and to Peter and David from Insight. Well done, Tommy. Thank you, special guest Martin. Thank you all for coming, and we'll see you online.
This is a podcast from Shooting People.